is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. The Ethiopian government launched a manhunt Sunday for leaders of the rebel faction in the northern region of Tigray after announcing federal troops had taken over the regional capital Mekele and military operations were finished. And the International Committee of the Red Cross said hospitals in the capital city are running low on supplies, such as gloves to care for the wounded, and one hospital is lacking body bags for the dead. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has been trying to quell a rebellion by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, a powerful ethnically based party that dominated the central government for nearly three decades before the current prime minister came to power in 2018. He said on Saturday night that federal troops had taken control of the capital city within hours of launching an offensive there. The TPLF leader told Reuters that his forces were withdrawn from the city but would fight on, raising the fear of a drawn-out guerrilla war. Thousands of people are believed to have been killed, and nearly 44,000 people have fled to neighboring Sudan since fighting began on November 4th. Diego Maradona's personal doctor was being investigated on Sunday for involuntary manslaughter 4 days after the Argentina football legend suffered a fatal heart attack. This is according to prosecutors near Buenos Aires. Police raided the doctor's surgery and home in search of possible evidence pointing to negligence, according to TV images. The probe was triggered by concerns raised by three of the soccer star's daughters over the treatment he received for his heart condition in his home in Tigray. Judicial sources are saying he died at age 60 of a heart attack on Wednesday and was buried on Thursday at a cemetery near Buenos Aires. This is VOA News. Brazil's biggest cities, São Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, began electing their next mayor Sunday as the country holds municipal runoffs in 57 cities. These are the last polls before President Jair Bolsonaro is up for re-election in 2022. In São Paulo, Brazil's economic capital, both candidates for mayor have had the coronavirus in the past, and the virus has affected the municipal elections in other ways. The polls were postponed by 6 weeks because of the pandemic, with the period between the first and second rounds reduced from 4 weeks to two. And authorities are urging voters to bring their own pens, respect social distancing guidelines, and disinfect their hands multiple times. Bolsonaro, who has downplayed the virus as a little flu, faces criticism for his handling of the pandemic, which has killed more than 172,000 people in Brazil, the second highest death toll worldwide after the United States. A volcano in Indonesia is erupting Sunday, belching a column of smoke and ash 4 kilometers into the sky. It's triggered a flight warning and the closure of the local airport. There were no reports of injuries or damage from the eruption in a remote part of the Southeast Asian island chain, but authorities raised the volcano's alert status to its second highest level as they warned of possible lava flows. Indonesia is home to about 130 active volcanoes. It's located on the Ring of Fire tectonic plate boundaries circling the Pacific Ocean, where seismic activity is frequent. In late 2018, a volcano in the strait between Java and Sumatra Islands erupted, causing an underwater landslide leading to a tsunami, which killed more than 400. The actor who played the Star Wars Darth Vader character has died at age 85. David Prowse, the British actor behind the villain's menacing black mask, passed away yesterday morning, according to his agent on Sunday. "May the force be with him always," the agent told the BBC. Mark Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker in the series, tweeted that he was so sad to hear about David Prowse's passing, that he was a kind man and much more than Darth Vader. A former bodybuilder turned actor, Prowse's towering height at almost 2 meters won him the role of the bad guy in the original Star Wars trilogy. But while he wore the black armor and cape, his thick Western English accent meant the filmmakers turned to American actor James Earl Jones for the deep and booming voice behind the mask. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the transition to a Biden administration is officially underway. How will President-elect Biden's new team of diplomatic and national security officials deal with the challenges left by U.S. President Donald Trump? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Barely 1 week after the U.S. presidential election, President Trump, who has yet to officially concede, fired Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Several days later, Esper's successor, Christopher Miller, the fourth official to lead the Pentagon under Mr. Trump, announced a troop drawdown in Afghanistan with plans to reduce the overall numbers of U.S. troops to 2,500 by early 2021. Analysts say the Taliban seems to be portraying the announcement of the U.S. troop drawdown as part of its narrative claiming victory over the United States. President Trump is ordering a reduction of 500 troops from Iraq. This week, President-elect Joe Biden has introduced the individuals he plans to nominate for top foreign policy and national security posts in his administration. The group includes Antony Blinken, one of Biden's closest foreign affairs advisors, as the choice for Secretary of State. In addition, he has nominated Alejandro Mayorkas to be Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Avril Haines to be Director of National Intelligence, Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Jake Sullivan to be National Security Advisor, and John Kerry to be Special Presidential Envoy for Climate. Once these appointees are confirmed by the U.S. Senate, how will they deal with the legacy of the Trump administration? How will the U.S. posture change, especially vis-a-vis U.S. policy in the Middle East? Well, joining us to analyze these important questions are two distinguished regional analysts. Ellen Lapson is professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University. Previously, she held senior national security positions in the U.S. government and served as CEO of the Stimson Center. And Kenneth Pollack, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. That's a policy group here in Washington. He works on Middle Eastern political military affairs. Before joining AEI, Ken Pollack was affiliated with the Brookings Institution, where he was a senior fellow at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy. He also served twice at the National Security Council. And both panelists join me via Microsoft Teams. Ellen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Carol. I'm glad to be with you.
And Ken Pollack, it's a pleasure to have you back as well.
Thank you. Pleasure for me to be here.
Ellen, let me go first to you to talk about the troop drawdown in Afghanistan. Now, this move has been criticized by U.S. and NATO military commanders, in addition to many Republican and Democratic lawmakers, as precipitous. They argue, especially NATO Secretary General, that the price for leaving too soon or in an uncoordinated fashion could be high. How do you interpret this announcement by Mr. Trump?
Well, it's clear that the military are quite uncomfortable with the president's decision, which is to essentially accelerate a process that was already underway, but very carefully negotiated, first with the Taliban and now hopefully with a process that brings both the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan together in some kind of a formal dialogue. Basically, the president's proposal is, I believe, somewhat politically motivated to demonstrate that he followed through on his pledge to get out of these endless wars, the phrase he's used. But what he's done is he's accelerated a process that is essentially not necessarily important to the diplomatic and political goal of trying to get the United States out of Afghanistan with some semblance of dignity and with a policy that we could essentially have a narrative that we chose to leave. We did not win the war in terms of bringing all of the objectives we had of bringing stability and better governance to Afghanistan. But most importantly, it gives a sort of unnecessary extra victory to the Taliban. I mean, here they are in the catbird seat because they've been the ones to negotiate the withdrawal of American forces, very much undermining the psychology and even the appearance of political legitimacy of the government in Kabul. Pulling over 2,000 American troops out even faster than originally planned only weakens the government in Kabul further. And I think it is possible that if this withdrawal is achieved in the time frame that President Trump has given the military, it will only undermine the government in Kabul and make that delicate negotiation between the Taliban and the government even harder and possibly bring it to a halt.
What is the reaction by the Afghan government?
Yeah, so well, Ambassador Khalilzad negotiated with the Taliban. The government in Kabul was quite furious. I mean, they really already felt that the United States had almost betrayed them, even though our objective was to do anything possible to put in place a political process that would bring some level of reconciliation. One cannot ignore that the Taliban have made themselves a player in Afghan politics, and the country cannot be stable without at least a conversation with the Taliban about security conditions in the country. So, you know, we are now at odds with our client, if you will, President Ashraf Ghani in Kabul. Everything that has happened in the last few months has worked to only alienate him from the United States. So it's quite messy. And while the Biden administration may agree with the principle that it is time to get out of Afghanistan and that we're not going to be able to wrap this up with a pretty bow and say, didn't we do a great job? Nonetheless, the way it's done only adds to the diplomatic challenge to the new administration.
Turning to you, Ken Pollack, with respect to Iraq, do you think that the drawdown of 500 troops in Iraq will equally hamstring the incoming Biden administration? What's your take on the drawdown in Iraq?
I certainly think that it's unhelpful. I don't think that it's going to be as unhelpful, as problematic as Ellen described it for Afghanistan. I think she's absolutely right about Afghanistan. But, you know, in Iraq, it perpetuates this pattern that we have seen for years and years in Iraq of playing games with troop numbers based on what politicians think will play best in terms of American domestic politics. And I think the truth of the matter is, I don't think the American public really cares whether we have 1,000 troops in Iraq or 10,000 troops in Iraq. They care about casualties. They care about whether those troops are actually making a difference. Right? And there, the troops still have a real purpose in Iraq. They're there to train the Iraqi military. They are there to keep a lid and to finish off ISIS and other terrorist groups. They're there to prevent the Iranians from taking over Iraq. Those are all very important missions. And I think that if you were to ask American military commanders, and you could get them to speak openly about it, I think they'd all tell you that the right number for those missions is probably somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 troops. But nevertheless, we continue to just shave off troops and shave off troops gratuitously so that different presidents can claim that they've done something meaningful. And again, all it does is doesn't change the public's perception of that presence in Iraq. All it does is make it harder for our troops in Iraq to get their job done. And potentially, you know, we could find ourselves in another situation exactly as we did in 2014, where again, we made a decision to pull troops out largely for domestic political reasons and only to find that it was a disaster. And we had to go back and recommit and send more troops. So is reducing the presence in Iraq by 500 troops all that meaningful? No, it isn't, but it's certainly disheartening to our military personnel and others who kind of look at American policy toward Iraq that we're continuing to play these games rather than asking, what do we need to get the job done?
Ken Pollack, how does the Iraqi government view this announcement?
They're not wild about it, but they recognize that it could be a lot worse. They know that President Trump would have loved to have been able to tell his constituency, I got everybody out of Iraq altogether. Cutting the presence by just 500 troops really isn't a very big deal. They don't like the symbolism of it, but they recognize that keeping the vast majority, keeping 2,500 troops in Iraq, was far more important than reducing it by 500.
Ellen Lapson, let's take a look at the Biden national security team that was just rolled out. I'd love to get your perspective on this national security foreign policy team and how they will differ from the Trump administration.
So first of all, I think these are serious, competent people who know how the government works. They will work well together. So very strong in terms of their familiarity with Biden. But if we take as a premise that Biden expects to spend 80% of his time on domestic issues between COVID and the economy, you know, racial and social injustice, polarization, et cetera, he needs a team that he really knows well and trusts. And I think he's achieved that.
Ken Pollack, what's your take on the new Biden foreign policy national security team?
I think she's absolutely right. This is an extremely experienced team. It is a very competent team. It is a very smart team. I will also add, and this is kind of piggybacking off of Ellen's point, it's a very centrist team. And I think that there were lots of folks on the right who were terrified that we were going to get a bunch of socialists coming in. That's clearly not the case. And I never expected it would be because, of course, that's not who Joe Biden is, right? And as Ellen nicely pointed out, Biden clearly is picking people that he likes, that he trusts, that reflect how he sees the world, right? And in that point, it's also important to note that there were lots of people who either hoped or feared that Joe Biden was going to be a third term for President Obama. I always thought that that was a mistake because people always expect that. It's never the case, right? The vice presidents who become presidents, they are always who they want to be. George H.W. Bush, Richard Nixon, I mean, we can go all the way back if you want to. And I think that's what Joe Biden is doing. As Ellen points out, the economy and the pandemic are going to consume easily 80% of this administration's time, energy, and political capital. And so the group that has to deal with foreign policy is going to have a lot of work to do without a whole lot of tools with which to do it.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Ellen Lapson. She's professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Ken Pollack. He's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We're discussing President Trump's proposal to draw down U.S. troops from Afghanistan and Iraq and what impact this and other policies may have on the incoming Biden administration. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a fan and listener from Islamabad, Pakistan, Malak Izaz Saib. If you want to hear your name and home country on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program and our discussion of foreign policy, particularly toward the Middle East. Back to you, Ellen Lapson. What about your take on how the U.S. policy will differ under a Biden administration than from the Trump administration, particularly because some analysts argue that President Trump's most positive foreign policy legacy will lie in the greater Middle East, formalization of agreements between Israel and three Arab states, overrunning the Islamic State territory in Syria and Iraq. But on the other hand, you know, he withdrew from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. There are a number of challenges. President-elect Biden has said that he would like to rejoin the JCPOA, but it's not going to be so simple. What are the challenges for the new administration vis-a-vis Iran?
So I quite agree that Iran is going to be the hardest problem for President-elect Biden because it is true that it was an Obama legacy to have this extraordinary diplomatic achievement of that joint comprehensive plan of action that was signed by six countries and Iran in 2015. And it was hard fought battle to get formal approval of the JCPOA. And I think Biden in his heart believes that we should at least go back as much as we can to the assumptions and provisions of that accord. But lots of complicating factors of how do you get the U.S. back in compliance? How do you get the Iranians back in compliance? How do you add the missing pieces of Iran's behavior in regional wars and conflicts and certainly Iran's missile developments that were never part of the 2015 agreement? Very tricky, lots of legal arguments about whether the agreement is still in existence and therefore we can just rejoin it, or I personally think trying to renegotiate a new agreement may be just too hard. But let's also just flag a couple of points of continuity. I think that from Obama through Trump to Biden, there is a desire to make the Middle East less central in U.S. national security concerns. There will still, I assume, be both a robust civilian and military presence in the region. But I hear among the Biden advisors some greater tolerance for, you know, well, the Russians can play a constructive role and we're not going to go to war with China over the Middle East, and a bit of a tolerance that the region will be a multipolar environment and more regional ownership of regional problems. So I do see a somewhat less ambitious American profile in the region. And having said that, I think President Biden will very much enjoy reestablishing personal relations with the leaders in the region, and they're all perfectly happy to work with him, including Israel. The one outlier might be Saudi Arabia, because if we take Biden's human rights interest, his democracy interests, and his fretting over the Saudi, you know, Khashoggi affair, Saudi Arabia in Yemen, et cetera, that relationship may be a little more tense than it's been under President Trump.
That's a terrific overview. So over to you, Ken Pollack, for your take. Now, President-elect Biden can rejoin the WHO and the Paris Climate Accord pretty much from day one, but it's not going to be so easy to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA. What is your take about the challenges regarding U.S. policy toward Iran? And even though the United States, as Ellen said, may want to have a certain amount of continuity between Obama, Trump, and Biden, maybe a less higher profile in the Middle East, pivoting more to East Asia, nonetheless, we have challenges and important ones that we need to address as the United States in the region. I'd like to get your take on those.
Sure. I think that's absolutely right, Carol. Let me peel back the onion on Iran another layer beyond where Ellen started us off, because, you know, I think that there is a widespread perception that this isn't going to be hard, right? The U.S. will come back into the JCPOA, and the assumption is that the Iranians are going to welcome that because it's an opportunity to get rid of the, you know, very severe sanctions imposed by the Trump administration. And Americans just assume, we have this bad habit of mirror imaging, the Iranians and the Iranian leadership will care about their economy first and foremost, exactly the way that we would, and that this will be their priority. And I think that that's very problematic as we think about Iran because of the domestic political changes that have taken place in Iran as a result of Trump's approach to Iran. So very quickly, because this is enormously complex. The agreement, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear agreement, was struck between the Obama administration and a group of relative moderates in the Iranian regime. President Hassan Rouhani and Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, these are people who believe in a better relationship with the United States. And against the opposition of Iran's hardliners, they convinced Iran's supreme leader to go ahead, make the deal with the United States in the assumption that the U.S. would lift the sanctions. This would revive Iran's economy. It would make their people happy, and the Iranian regime would benefit accordingly. Iran's hardliners fought this tooth and nail. They didn't want to end their nuclear program. They didn't want a better relationship with the United States. And what they consistently argued was the Americans will cheat, they will renege on the deal, and by the way, the deal is too favorable to the Americans to begin with. So when President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the JCPOA, it was seen in Iran as complete confirmation and validation of the hardline position. And what we've seen over the last 2-3 years is that Rouhani and Zarif and other more pragmatic and moderate Iranian politicians have been running for the hills. They are on the defensive. The hardliners are very much in control. And the foreign policy we've been seeing from Iran is a hardline foreign policy. We're going to have elections, presidential elections in Iran in June of next year. I think it highly likely that we will get a hardliner replacing Rouhani as Iran's president. And what we've consistently heard from the hardliners, including on several occasions from the supreme leader himself, is he's not interested in negotiating with the United States. He's not interested in coming back to the nuclear deal because his argument is the Americans cheat, they lie, the deal wasn't good enough for us to begin with. Why on earth should we trust the Americans again? And I think there are a lot of Americans who just assume that's a bargaining position. Maybe he's holding out to get a better deal. But I think that we need to recognize that that actually represents very accurately where Iran's hardliners are, probably where Khamenei is himself, and that they are very much in the driver's seat. And for all of these reasons, I think the Biden administration could have a very difficult time bringing the Iranians back into the nuclear deal. And that is going to make dealing with Iran a whole lot harder, because I think there's no question what they're really hoping, even though they know it is going to be tough, is that they can convince the Iranians to just forget about the last 4 years, go back to 2015-16. They come back into their compliance requirements under the JCPOA. We lift the sanctions, and we just all forget about the last 4 years. And I think, unfortunately, the last 4 years have dramatically changed Iran's domestic politics in a way that's going to make it very hard for us to do that, which then, as you were pointing out before, also makes it hard for the U.S. to say, you know what, we're going to play less of a role in the Middle East. There's less to worry about there. We can concentrate on other parts of the world instead. There's a widespread misperception that America's allies, the Israelis, the Saudis, the Emiratis, loved the Trump administration. They don't. They didn't. They felt betrayed by the Trump administration, which talked a good game and allowed them to do more or less what they wanted, but gave them no support. And they found that terrifying and an incredible betrayal. And there will be a lot of room for a Biden administration to come back in and say, we'd like to go back to a more traditional American approach. We are going to support you. But of course, that's where things get tricky, because as you and Ellen have both pointed out, we're not going to go back to the George W. Bush era or even the Clinton era, let alone the George H.W. Bush era, where the United States was making the Middle East one of its primary regions of focus and willing to invest lots of resources and political capital. So that's going to be a trick for the Biden administration, is how do we start to rebuild those relationships and convince our allies that we really are going to support them without getting overcommitted the way that we have in the past?
Ellen, we have very little time, but I wanted to ask you if you would like to comment on what Ken just said, but also with respect to the Israelis and the Palestinians, the legacy that President Trump has left behind. He has backed this anti-Iran alliance, bringing together Israel and Arab states. We saw the signing of three diplomatic accords between Israel and the UAE, Bahrain, and then Sudan. How do you think the Biden administration can repair relations? But also, to what extent will President-elect Biden build on what President Trump left behind with respect to these deals, or maybe diverge from them, particularly with respect to Israel, where many analysts say the United States has gone too far to defend the Bibi Netanyahu administration?
I think that the Abraham Accords, the three normalization agreements, and probably the moving of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, the Biden folks are just going to say, fine, that's the new reality, in a positive way, too, that Israel normalizing relations with additional Arab countries is good, it's positive, maybe economic and scientific cooperation can take place, that's all good. But it misses the point that the strategic intervention by the Trump administration to tilt the balance even further, saying that Israel's security is paramount and that, you know, the natural rights of the Palestinian people are somehow of very secondary, if not tertiary, importance, that's going to be very hard for the Biden administration to decide how much time and investment do they want to spend walking that back. I think some real damage has been done that uproots what were decades of carefully crafted American policies on these issues. So I think there's very little prospect for a complete turnaround in Arab-Israeli things. And the Trump administration, in the end, had the consolation prize of the Abraham Accords, but failed to achieve its much vaunted greater Middle East peace plan.
Last word to you, Ken.
Again, just to tack on a point, what we really need to keep sight of here is that everyone is talking about the Abraham Accords as potentially being the end of the Arab-Israeli conflict and how wonderful that would be. And it would be a wonderful thing. But there are two issues out there we need to keep in mind. One, as Ellen was alluding to, the Palestinians are still there and they're still miserable and they still are living in limbo. And that situation needs to be dealt with for the good of the Palestinians, needs to be dealt with for the good of Israelis, and ultimately for the stability of that part of the world. And second, you know, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that if you want to talk about the contribution of the Trump administration to the Abraham Accords, again, it was the Trump administration ultimately abandoning our allies in the region, particularly the Emirates and the Saudis, who, if you remember, were attacked repeatedly and egregiously by the Iranians all throughout 2019. That was absolutely terrifying to the Saudis and the Emiratis. They realized that the United States, at least under Donald Trump, was no longer going to help them against Iran. They needed to find someone else to do so. And they decided that if you couldn't have the U.S., the Israelis were perhaps the next best thing. The problem is that ultimately we need to recognize this is a war coalition. As much good as may come of it, this is really about the Israelis and the Sunni Arab states gearing up for a potential war against Iran. That would not be good for the Middle East, for our allies, or for us.
On that note, I'm afraid that is all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ellen Lapson, professor and director of the Center for Security Policy Studies at George Mason University, and Kenneth Pollack, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Katie Weaver and Mario Ritter bring us the Education Report. They talk about how the COVID-19 pandemic is causing a sharp drop in international enrollment at colleges and universities in the United States. For this week's Words and Their Stories, Gregory Stockel tells us about words dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the Education Report.
Sai Nani of India is just 2 terms short of completing a master's degree program in the United States. The 28-year-old studies cybersecurity at the University of Toledo in Ohio, or he used to. Last summer, Nani had to leave school suddenly when his father became very sick with the disease COVID-19. He reached the hospital in India just 4 hours before his father died. "He was emotional. He was in tears," Nani said. "I think he was waiting to see someone who would take care of my mother, and then he left." 2 months later, when Nani was ready to return to the university, U.S. officials denied his visa request. He said the only explanation he got is that the decision was based on guidelines they received from the White House. "Everything changed," Nani said. "The goals I had changed. The milestones I had changed."
Problems and new policies brought on by COVID-19 have stopped thousands of international students from attending U.S. colleges this year. The sharp drop could lead to long-lasting effects in schools that depend financially on international students. At risk are millions of dollars in tuition payments and some of the world's best minds for U.S. employers. The number of new international students has been falling in recent years because of rules limiting student visas and competition from other countries. But COVID-19 has been a crushing blow. New international student enrollment in U.S. universities this term is down by 43%. That number comes from a new study of more than 700 schools. The nonprofit Institute of International Education reported the findings. The group has been publishing data on international enrollment since 1954. The study found total international enrollment, including new and returning students, fell by 16%. And it showed that among those who did enroll at U.S. colleges, about 1 in 5 were studying online from outside the United States.
Some of the nation's largest universities experienced a big drop in international students. The number of undergraduate and graduate international students at Michigan State University was down 20%. The University of Texas reported a drop of 17%. The state university systems in Arizona and Ohio each said that foreign student enrollment shrank by 15%. Administrators agree the pandemic created barriers for students, from job losses and financial difficulty to worries over U.S. government policies. Universities were flooded with questions from concerned parents. They wanted to know where their children would live if colleges closed student housing. They wanted to know what would happen if their child got sick. Some students decided to stay home because of those worries. It all has forced students to make difficult choices. One University of Toledo student decided not to go home, even when two relatives died of COVID-19, said Tracy Hidalgo, an official with the school. "They just bawl their eyes out and tell me no, because they're worried they're not going to be able to come back," she said.
Adding to the problems of the health crisis are worries about changes to U.S. immigration policy. Experts say there is a growing belief that the country is no longer as welcoming for international students. "The combination makes for a very difficult situation," said Leonardo Villalon, head of the University of Florida's International Center. "International higher education is under the greatest stress it has been in decades." The drop in enrollment will be felt in budgets at colleges because foreign students usually pay higher tuition than in-state students. The University of Illinois alone estimates it will lose about $26 million this term. And high-tech companies will suffer. They depend on foreign-born people who come to the U.S. for training, Villalon noted. "Where do we want the best and brightest young people in the world to go?" he said. "If you're running a research lab studying the coronavirus, you want the very best in there." There is hope among some college officials that President-elect Joe Biden will overturn some Trump administration immigration orders, as promised. Biden also has said he would seek a new pathway to citizenship for foreigners who complete U.S. doctoral programs. U.S. universities are also facing increased competition from countries, including Canada and Australia, that are appealing to foreign students. And China is heavily investing in its colleges.
Usman Bari is a Guinean refugee who moved to Italy. He won an academic scholarship to Whitman College in Washington State. Bari was to begin classes at the school last summer. but his visa request was turned down because he could not show enough ties to his home country. He still has hope that he will get another chance. Going to the United States to study is the best, he said, because of all the educational possibilities it offers. I'm not trying to work or spend my life there, said the 21-year-old. All I'm looking for is a better education, and then to go back to my country. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
And now, Gregory Stockel brings us this week's Words and Their Stories.
In today's Words and Their Stories, we will talk about words from the health crisis that affects all of us this year. Wendolyn Nichols is with Cambridge Dictionary. She said the words that people search for reveal not just what is happening in the world, but what matters most to them in relation to those events. The events of this year have sent people to search for words like coronavirus and COVID-19. It also brought words that we rarely used in the recent past, such as quarantine, lockdown, and pandemic. So what did Cambridge Dictionary choose as the 2020 word of the year? The answer is quarantine. Cambridge said searches for the word increased in March when many countries went into lockdown to stop the spread of the new coronavirus. The word has also taken on a new meaning, and Cambridge has since added to its definition. It now says quarantine is a general period of time in which people are not allowed to leave their homes or travel freely so that they do not catch or spread a disease. Collins Dictionary, another British publisher, chose lockdown for its word of the year. It said the word represents a uniting experience for people across the world. The publisher noted that lockdown was originally a word connected to prison life. When prisoners riot or cause other trouble, guards will lock them inside their cells to help return order to the prison. In 2020, Collins said under lockdown, normal public life is suspended, and we see few people and fewer places. The meaning of the word has changed in people's mind. Lockdown is now a public health measure. On March 11th, the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus crisis a pandemic. At a news conference that day, the World Health Organization's Director General said, "Pandemic is not a word to use lightly or carelessly." The Merriam-Webster Learner's Dictionary says pandemic is an event in which a disease spreads very quickly and affects a large number of people over a wide area or throughout the world. Both Oxford and Collins said pandemic received consideration as their word of the year. The Oxford Dictionary, however, did not select pandemic or any single word as its word of the year. Oxford Dictionary officials said 2020 is not a year that could be described in a single word. So, it decided to look at words as they changed throughout the year in a Words of an Unprecedented Year report. It was bushfire in January when more than 200 fires were burning across Australia. In February, everyone was talking about the impeachment of U.S. President Donald Trump. The month of March brought coronavirus, followed by COVID-19. Then came lockdown, social distancing, reopening, hand sanitizer, coverings, and super spreader. In June was the month for Black Lives Matter after American police killed Black citizen George Floyd in late May. Mail-in saw increased usage in August as Americans looked for ways to vote safely during the pandemic. In 2019, Merriam-Webster chose they as its word of the year. The word they has no gender and can be used in place of he or she. The American Dictionary publisher has yet to choose its word of the year for 2020. However, the online betting website Sportsbook Review says the word COVID-19 is the heavy favorite to become Webster's word of the year. And that's Words and Their Stories. I'm Gregory Stockel.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President Abraham Lincoln led the Union of Northern States in 4 years of civil war against the Southern Confederacy. But he did not live to see the end of the war. He did not live to see the nation reunited. He was assassinated in April of 1865. Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell what happened after Lincoln died.
Almost immediately, officials began planning details of the president's funeral. They asked Mrs. Lincoln where she wanted her husband buried. At first, she said Chicago. That was where the Lincolns were going to live after they left the White House. Then she said the Capitol building in Washington. A tomb had been built there for America's first president, George Washington, but it had never been used. Finally, she remembered a country cemetery they had visited. At the time, her husband had said, "When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." So Mrs. Lincoln decided that the president's final resting place would be in the quiet, beautiful Oak Ridge Cemetery outside their hometown of Springfield, Illinois.
For several days after Lincoln's assassination, his body lay in the East Room of the White House. The room was open to the public all day. Next, the body was taken to the Capitol building. Again, the public could come to say goodbye. Then the body was put on a special train for the trip back to Illinois. 4 years earlier, President-elect Lincoln had traveled by train from Illinois to Washington. He stopped to make speeches in cities along the way. Now, on this sad return trip, the train stopped at those same cities: Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Chicago.
In every town, people lined the railroad. They stood silently with tears in their eyes as the train moved slowly past. Farmers working in the fields saw the train and dropped to their knees in prayer. For the wise man who had led the Union through 4 years of bloody civil war, Father Abraham, was dead. Churches throughout the country held memorial services. Ministers told their people that God had taken Lincoln because the president had completed the job God had given him. He had brought peace to the Union and freedom to all men.
The final service was at the cemetery outside Springfield. It ended with the words from Lincoln's second inaugural speech. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
While the nation mourned Lincoln's death, federal officials investigated his assassination. The man who had shot Lincoln in Ford's Theater was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. He had fled the theater after the murder. The government offered a reward of $100,000 to anyone who captured Booth and his helpers. The investigation produced the names of several people who were friends of Booth. One was John Surratt. Like Booth, he supported the Southern Confederacy during the Civil War. Another was David Herold, a young man who worked in a store in Washington. Others were George Atzerodt, Louis Payne, Sam Arnold, and Michael O'Loughlin. Most of these men had stayed at a house owned by John Surratt's mother, Mary.
One by one, in the days following Lincoln's death, these people were arrested. Anyone else who might have had a part in the plot was seized. Soon, hundreds of suspects were being held in jails in and around Washington. At the end of a week, only two of the plotters were still free, David Herold and John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he jumped from the presidential box to the stage at Ford's Theater. A few hours later, he and Herold stopped at the home of a Dr. Samuel Mudd. They reportedly gave the doctor false names. They asked him to fix Booth's broken leg. Dr. Mudd agreed, and he let the two men sleep at his home. Federal troops chasing the assassins arrested the doctor. They accused him of being part of the plot.
John Wilkes Booth and David Herold ran and hid for 6 days. They crossed the Potomac River from Maryland into Virginia. Finally, 12 days after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, soldiers found the two men. They were hiding in a tobacco barn near the town of Port Royal. Herold agreed to surrender. He came out of the barn with his hands in the air. He shouted again and again that he was innocent. Booth refused to come out. The soldiers set fire to the barn.
The fire forced Booth to move close to the door. The soldiers could see him now. He was aiming a gun at them. The soldiers had been ordered to capture Booth alive, but one of them raised his gun and shot Booth in the neck. The actor fell. Some of the soldiers ran to the burning barn and pulled him out. They carried him to a nearby house. He died 2 hours later.
John Wilkes Booth carried a notebook. He wrote in it every day. On the day Lincoln was killed, he wrote, "For 6 months we had worked to kidnap Lincoln, but with the Confederacy being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done. I struck boldly." Booth described how and why he had shot the president. "Our country," Booth wrote, "owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment." Booth's body was returned to Washington. Men who knew him confirmed that it was the body of John Wilkes Booth. The body was buried under the stone floor of the Washington prison. A few years later, his family received permission to move the body to a cemetery in the city of Baltimore.
Evidence showed that only a few people were actually involved in the plot against the president. Most had agreed to work with Booth because they believed he planned to kidnap Lincoln, not kill him. Of the hundreds of persons arrested, only 8 were brought to trial. The Secretary of War decided that they would be tried by a military court. He argued that Lincoln had been commander-in-chief of all military forces and had been murdered during wartime.
The trial began almost 2 months after the assassination. The prisoners seemed in poor condition. All wore heavy chains on their arms and legs, and the men had been forced to wear thick cloths over their heads. Officials said the cloths were necessary to prevent them from talking to each other. The Secretary of War announced that the prisoners could not meet privately with their defense lawyers. They could meet only in the courtroom. Guards could hear everything they said. One of the defense lawyers recognized that the job was hopeless. He said the trial was a contest between the defense lawyers and the whole United States. There was no question, he said, what the military court's decision would be.
The government tried to prove that Lincoln's assassination was a Confederate plot. Witnesses told how Confederate supporters reportedly planned to cause trouble in the North. But none could prove that Confederate President Jefferson Davis, or any other Southern leader, played a part in Booth's plot to kill Lincoln. 400 witnesses appeared. Many of the important ones had been arrested as suspects. They agreed to give evidence if the government dropped the charges against them. For 6 weeks, the court heard evidence against the 8 prisoners. The prisoners themselves could say nothing. They could only listen.
In late June 1865, the trial of Abraham Lincoln's assassins ended. The military officers serving as judges met secretly for 2 days. Then they announced their decision. All 8 prisoners were found guilty. One received a prison sentence of 6 years. 3 were sentenced to life in prison. 4 were sentenced to die. Defense lawyers appealed for mercy. The appeal was rejected. On July 7th, David Harold, Louis Payne, George Atzerodt, and Mary Surratt were hanged for the murder of Abraham Lincoln.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world.